Well, this is Windows Runtime for the Windows Phone Developer. My name is Jerry Nixon. I work for Microsoft. I am a developer evangelist. So a developer evangelist is pretty sweet job. It's a lot like sales, only I don't have a quota or don't have anything to really sell you. I work totally in the hearts and minds of people. That's all that it's about. It's about manipulation for the most part. Not true, but I mean, in a way, you know, it sort of is. But my job is to go and find all the trouble that developers are having, help them get past it, and find all the haters, which there's plenty in the world, try and soften them at least just a little bit. And sometimes I can do it. Sometimes I just can't. People are so, their hat is too red, so to speak. And so that's just the way it goes. By the way, I will point out this is my URL for my blog, jerrynixon.com, which is a worthwhile resource if you find yourself to be a XAML developer. I talk about XAML pretty much 100%, and so my blog is loaded with XAML things for you. I'm also the author of probably the three most important Microsoft Virtual Academies for XAML developers: the C# Fundamentals, Basic XAML for Windows Store, and Advanced XAML for Windows Store. Those are all-day courses that are free with Microsoft Virtual through Microsoft Virtual Studio or Virtual Academy, and there you go. You can get to them all from my website as well. A lot of developers come to me and say, okay, you sold me on XAML. Now, how do I start? And it's a difficult question to ask. Okay, but back to the runtime. It's not about XAML. What we're going to talk about today is just kind of the run through the past so that we know kind of where we've come from and where we're headed with Windows Phone, the future of Windows Phone, the direction, kind of trajectory of where things are going. And then we'll talk about the options that you have as a phone developer, whether or not you choose to build on Windows Phone Silverlight or you choose to build on Windows Phone for WinRT or Windows Runtime. And we'll talk about the advantages of each. It's not a slam dunk on which one you choose. It really depends on the type of app you're going to write. And then we'll just talk about the runtime as a whole, so that the assumption today is you're familiar with Windows Phone, but you have decided to go the route of the runtime. And there's things that you'll need to know and transition your knowledge over from what you already know and are comfortable with to the runtime. This will be relevant, by the way, for developers who go and build Windows apps as well, because now that we have a convergence between them all and a single runtime for each of them, as you learn one, you learn the other. The nuances between them is really, they're really very thin. So let's look back and see where we've come from. Not so many years ago, just about three, Windows Phone 7.0 was released to great fanfare. Anyway, 7.0 was a complete rewrite of Windows Mobile, right? And mobile was the CE version of Windows. And it supported all kinds of things, but not too long after that, we introduced the Shocker engine, started syncing up Internet Explorer with what was in Phone, and revving it to, this was called the Mango release, 7.5, not so long ago. Then 8 came out. 8 was last year. 8 was the first time we introduced the Windows kernel, the Windows 8 kernel, inside Windows Phone. And this was really the beginning of the transition. So we, thanks to this kernel, we could support things like multi-core and other things that we just couldn't do before. And then along comes Windows Phone 8.1. So 8.1 was released to build just a few weeks ago. And that was pretty exciting. 8.1 is a continuation of Silverlight. And so we have Silverlight all the way through. And by what I mean when Silverlight is, of course, not the browser plugin. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the XAML specification that meets the Silverlight spec. And so when you looked at 7, for example, that was like Silverlight 3. 7.5 was maybe 3.5, you know, maybe something around that. Maybe we got to 4 before we finally totally diverged and became a more of a phone version of Silverlight. But at the exact same time that we released 8.1, we also release 8.1 WinRT. So now you have two choices, two paths that you can pick. The first would be to continue with the investment you may have already made in Silverlight. The second one would be to go towards a WinRT version of XAML, a WinRT version of API, set of APIs, and a set basically that will be identical on Windows as well. So that would be where this is kind of headed toward. It's, you know, it's very important that the top line continue, right? Because there's a lot of investment. We have 250,000 apps in the store today. We certainly don't want to undermine those or pull the rug out from under them. And so there's a continued investment and a ramp up of features and capabilities on the top line But then we have this introduction of the bottom line. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. But let's think about Silverlight just for a second. There's some reasons you would stay beyond just the fact that you've already invested a certain amount of code and development effort into it. That might be the one reason, right? And the reality is we respect your investment. We're not looking for you to make a major change. But we want to give you the option to have converged code base if that's what you want. And so the other one might be the install base. Today you might have a title that's about to be published, or you may have an app that's about to be released, or you may already have an app and you're thinking about going to a second version. For that reason, you might want to release today in Silverlight 8.1 because you would have the largest install base today, right? All Windows phones are going to be able to continue down the Silverlight path. For that reason, if you really wanted to release it yesterday, like as fast as possible, you might actually release it in 8.0, right? So you don't have to wait for people to upgrade. Then again, there might be a type of app that you want to write that simply isn't supported yet in the converged version, converged world, or the universal app. You might want to write your own voice over IP app for one reason or another. If you do, that's not just simply not a capability right now. Same thing with if clipboard is important to you. If camera lens is what you want to write, that's a big differentiator for the Windows phone, the ability to intercept the stream and create your own lens for the camera. Right? There's a lot of apps already like that now. If you want to write some sort of app that interacts with lock screen wallpaper, right? You want to be a provider now for lock screen wallpaper. Great, you can totally do that, but that's another reason you would stay on the Silverlight platform. If you wanted to run under the lock screen for some reason, right? You wanted the phone to go ahead and shut down, not shut down, but for the screen to turn off, and you still to be able to operate under it, those types of apps are totally realistic, and there's a lot of them like it. That is still on the Silverlight side as well. So you can see there's still a gap, but it's not a gigantic gap, and these certainly are edge cases as well. If you decide to stay with Silverlight, which is totally fantastic, right? There's a couple things that you get thanks to the upgrade to 8.1. So is it still worth going from 8.0 to 8.1? Well, I think it is. Part of the reason is you get to take advantage of new APIs to access the SD card. If you want to use the cool geofencing technology so that you can create a radius around some lat-long position, and you want a trigger to fire as soon as you go into that, and then you want some activity to happen, that's all there. All you have to do is retarget up to 8.1. In fact, let me show you something. I have there we are. I'm going to launch Visual Studio here, and I'm going to create a brand new project. You can see here in the tree where what you might have been used to seeing for Windows Phone, I'll go ahead and collapse this a little bit more, it's not there anymore. If I go down to Silverlight, that's the actual in-browser Silverlight, so that's not what I'm looking for. Instead, everything is inside this nested store apps. I can go to Universal Apps, Windows Apps, or Windows Phone, and as soon as I do, I can see there's the Windows Phone. When it just says Windows Phone, that means it's a universal app. It's not the Silverlight framework. All I have to do is scroll down to right here, and here is these are Silverlight. You can see the font's enormous, so it's kind of, there we go, right? So I could go to start with a pivot app or something like that. In fact, let me go ahead and do that. I'll create this pivot app. I'll just double-click it real quick, and it'll ask me what version of Windows Phone I want to write to. So assuming I have an 8.0 today, right, I would just leave it at 8.0, and I would say, okay. That'll give me something so I can show you how to retarget up to 8.1. So here's my app, and that's all there is to it. And I could right-click the project now, and there's a new retarget to Windows Phone 8.1. As soon as I select, it says, look, you need to know something. As soon as you retarget to 8.1, there's no going back, right? So you need to decide what your branching strategy is here. Hopefully you're using Visual Studio Online already. And if you are, then you can go ahead and branch a brand new one. You can label it if you don't like branching. And then you can go ahead and do your upgrade so you don't lose your original version. So here I am. I have just upgraded to 8.1. All the APIs stay the same. Now just the capabilities increase. It's really an easy retargeting experience. Then again, you may decide the time has come for you to go ahead and build the universal app. You want to make sure that the code that you're going to write is going to be as reusable as possible across all the different platforms. You recognize the trajectory that Microsoft is going and where they put their investments. And you realize that the Windows runtime is probably the future of Microsoft. And to continue down the Silverlight way, still gives you the functionality and maybe the life that you need for your app, but at the same time, it doesn't give you all the capability and flexibility you know is ultimately going to come, right? You have a Windows Phone app today, and you want to introduce it to Windows, perhaps. You have a Windows app today, and you want to introduce it to Phone, or you're writing one from scratch, and you don't want to write two, right? You just want to write one application. Obviously, that's going to be a universal app, so you get the most convergence. You certainly get the latest tooling. That's because all the investments being made into universal apps from this point forward. I didn't mean to say all. Obviously, we're still revving Silverlight. You also get new controls, right? There are lots of controls in your toolbox that you get for free. A couple of them that you would expect on Phone aren't on Phone, but we transition those over, like Panorama becomes Hub and things like that, as well as different language options. So now you can write your XAML application in C++ if that's important to you. You can mix and match those as well so that you can have a C++, you can have C#, you can have JavaScript, depending on what all your needs really are. So one thing to see that's sort of interesting, there are two projects here, one on the left, one on the right. And the one on the left is a typical Silverlight project, and the one on the right is a typical converged project or universal app. And it's nice. It's nice and tight. There's different ways of doing things, and we'll talk about what those different ways are. And we'll start with the runtime itself. The runtime itself, a lot of people confuse the runtime with the .NET framework, right? It feels almost like it's a new .NET framework, and it's the replacement of the old .NET framework. Old, I say. And we're obviously going to be deprecating the .NET framework away, which is not true at all, right? Of course that's not true. They don't really have anything to do with each other, except for they just feel the same. The .NET framework runs inside a CLR, the common language runtime, which sounds like the Windows runtime, and so now that's where the kind of confusion sort of swings. Well, interestingly enough, the Windows runtime itself still uses the same ECMA standard that .NET did, right? And so that's really interesting to start with. There's a lot of familiarity with it, but it's really a set of code that the runtime itself, we'll start with just the Windows runtime. It's really just an exposure of the operating system. So there are three things that the runtime will give you that you wouldn't otherwise get if you're writing let's say a desktop application in WPF. The first thing that it gives you is brokered access to resources. So this is a big deal. If I were to write an application in anything, right, whatever, any kind of desktop application, it wouldn't take me very long to screw up your machine, right? I could do it in a millisecond, perhaps. All you have to do is run my app, and I could just go right at it. I can go right to your hard drive and start erasing files that are important to you. I could go directly into your registry and start switching things around that you can't see behind the scenes. There's all kinds of danger around it, so that if you haven't given an app to a user, the user has no idea if you're about to wreck their machine or not, if you're about to turn their camera on without their permission, and on it goes, right? So the first thing is I have brokered access, secure access into resources. So now as a user, I can say I'm only going to run applications that run inside the Windows runtime, and as a result, here's what I know about that. Nobody's going to wreck my machine. No hard drive corruption is going to occur. Nobody can read or write from the registry. And I know for a fact that if anything is trying to touch my camera, my microphone, my SD card, you just name whatever it is, I can turn that on or I can turn that off, and it's up to me to give permission to it. And so the fear is relieved, right? It's not that you can't do absolutely anything, but because the runtime itself protects the user. Not only does it protect the user's machine from corruption, but it also protects the user's experience as well. And so one of the sandboxes that's around it is memory consumption. So I write an application that runs inside the runtime, and I know for a fact that my application won't consume more memory than it'll destroy the performance of my machine. So the user is protected again, because now I know that if some app goes crazy and starts, you know, because the developer did whatever and there's an internal loop or whatever, the runtime will shut it down for me and I don't have to worry about my experience on my device going bad, right? So when it all boils down to it, we want to create a predictable experience and a predictable and reliable user experience across every Windows device, and the runtime provides that for us. In fact, let me show you something really interesting. This idea of language projection is pretty cool. I have ILDASM here. ILDASM is the disassembler that we would use for .NET. So I would write a .NET application today, and I was going to build it. It would become an assembly. I could look at that assembly then in IL-DASM, and I could see all of its structure because it's given and created in that ECMA standard, right? So IL-DASM is able to read that. So I could say open, and whenever I go into I'm in Windows System 32 Win metadata. So now I'm not going to open a .NET assembly. Instead, what I'm going to open is a WinMD. So this is a Windows. I just lost it. It's a Windows. This is a Windows. This is a window. Bah. What is it? Well, this doesn't happen very often. Doesn't matter. A WinMD is what you compile into. A .NET compiles into an assembly. WinMD is what when you write it for Windows. I mean, the MD is for metadata, but a Windows component. Good gravy. Anyway, here are all the WinMDs that are pre-installed on my application or on my device. These are all the part that I would consider the framework that are already there for me. If I want to open one of these, I could easily open it and see that it's projected as .NET for me. I can see that right here. And what's great is because whenever I write a metadata file, whenever I'm writing one of these components, I have to follow a certain set of standards myself, right? I can only expose certain types. I can only have things that aren't .NET only types, right? I can't have classes that aren't sealed. And there's a handful, there are about five or six core rules that make it so that the application I write qualifies to be a WinMD. And as soon as I do, then from that point forward, it can be projected then back to me as a .NET project, so it feels as if I'm using a .NET assembly. But I could also go over to C++ and I could use that same WinMD, and it's projected to me now in types that C++ uses, right? So you know, every once in a while, you probably use something where like a pointer integer is used, and you have to convert that over into an integer. That's because you're really using something that's written and consumable by C++, and you're trying to use that in C#, and you're having to convert it into a .NET type. Well, none of that happens here, right? The runtime totally projects in the language that it's intended to be consumed in. So that means I'm writing in .NET, I always will get .NET types out of it. I'm writing in C++, I'll always get C++ ready types out of it. I'm writing in JavaScript, I'll get JavaScript ready types out of it, right? And so this language projection is possible from the because it's written as metadata. And so that's a big and important piece of it, and it's the part that allows us to support all these different languages without having to write in every different language. All we have to write is kind of in this intermediary language. So we talked about one of the things that it gives us is this brokered access to resources for the sake of the user's experience and kind of security. But it also gives us asynchronous programming. So you probably saw that await and async are now part of the C# standard. And you might be wondering why they were such a big deal and why there was such a drive. And maybe it had something to do with something was going on inside of Microsoft where asynchronous programming was going to be fundamental. And so fundamentally, inside WinMDs, inside the runtime, there are loads and loads and loads and loads of asynchronous calls. The reason they're asynchronous is because if you call them synchronously, it now locks the UI and it makes it so that the user's experience is really negative, right? It also makes it so that the marshaller has a difficult time determining whether or not you have a problem inside your application when it's trying to decide whether or not to cancel you and save the user, right? And so now we make things to be asynchronous. So we determine in advance. There's all kinds of things that you're going to want to do, right? Talk to the file system, talk to the USB drive, talk to the network, whatever it might be. And all these different operations, if we determine that it's going to take more or at least could take more than 50 milliseconds, then that needs to be totally awaitable, right? It has to be asynchronous, because if it's not asynchronous, then that 50 milliseconds is that lag. Maybe you have to do it twice. Maybe it's going to be longer than 50 milliseconds. So we do that to make sure that you have to do it asynchronously, because one, we want the user's experience to be positive and not the lag on the UI, and two, we want to monitor your application and make sure it's not hung, right? So now everything's operating asynchronously. We're not worried about your thread being totally hijacked. All right, so let's look at a little bit around the async API or the async syntax. There are really only two things about async that you need to remember. That's the async and await keywords. So this is a method. This is a button click method. Any method at any time can be decorated to become asynchronous. So in this case, you can see it has async right before void. That's saying from this point forward, this is going to be an asynchronous enabled method. It doesn't mean the method itself is asynchronous because nothing's happened yet that is going to be asynchronous. But the first thing is we'll new up our service, and now we're going to make a service call, and that service call is a long-running asynchronous operation. Now, if you had ever written asynchronous operations before, especially if you were doing like ASMX kind of calls or old school kind of web services, a lot of this you had to do just totally by hand. You would make the call. First, you would wire up to the completed event. Then you would make the call. Your completed event would fire. You would have some sort of state maintained between the two so that you wouldn't lose them. And then debugging was a real pain because you would call it and you would wait and the asynchronous call would happen. And if you happened to call two at a time, they could become out of sync and you really didn't know where your debugger was sitting. I mean, it was a really painful thing. And heaven forbid if you made 2, 3, 4, 6, 10, 20 asynchronous operations, then you had all kinds of, and it felt like spaghetti code even though you were doing the best that you really could. Debugging it was really hard. Error catching was an absolute nightmare. And just really being able to just for readability. So this is where await comes in. So here on the second line is await. Await is a combination of both the call to the asynchronous request and the wire up of the handler for the completed event all at the same time. Await is basically saying call it and then just content and then wait here, wait here for the operation to be complete for that final event to be raised that it's been completed, and then continue. But in the meantime, I want you to release this method. So now, you know, you've probably seen it before where you click on a button and the button gets held down because the button is doing something in the background and you're waiting for that button to finally be released, and then finally it is released, right? That's because it's not running asynchronously the way it should be. It's running synchronously. It's holding that button down, locking the UI, and changing it so that the user experience is really quite negative. You click on it a couple times, you move your mouse, you start to see the trails behind it because things just aren't right. Then you get not responding in the title. And so that's not what we want. So instead, we do it at await right there. Now, what's cool is, as soon as it releases, the third line does not occur. So the third line will not occur until the fetch data async completes. Then all the operation is done. Right? That's the way that you want it to be. We also have another concept. And so one of the things that an app written in Windows Store app, the way it's written, is it can be suspended at any time. So when it is suspended, you want to be able to handle something. One of the ways you may handle a suspension is to save your data. Being able to save your data, say, to a file, might be an asynchronous action. If you do that asynchronous action, the suspending event will release immediately. Well, as soon as it does, the system that's calling you to warn you about the suspension now thinks that you're done saving all your data and it'll go ahead and suspend you, but you're still in the middle of saving your data because you're awaiting it. So now we have the idea of deferrals. I can get a deferral on any asynchronous operation like this. I can get the deferral that basically says you're about to be released, this method is about to be released, but just hold on, right? This is a lot like triggers were used for but anyway, that's the reason we have a get deferral, so we can do asynchronous operations, release the method, but still indicate to the consumer or indicate out to the calling system that we're not quite done. So that's all I'm going to talk about for asynchronous. I will say it is a relatively complicated topic, and if you want to learn more about this or anything else in C#, there is a pretty cool AKMS. CS Fun is C# Fundamentals. And it's an 8-hour course on C#, and it's all free, and it's great, and it's cool. And you'll love it. I taught it, and I have to say, I mean, the teacher learns more than the student, period, right? I mean, if you have to say it all, there's so much you have to know. And I had forgotten more about C# than I had even dreamed. It was just unbelievable. I have an app up here, and let me just, I'll start another brand new app. This time I'll go up and I'll create a universal app, a blank universal app. So as soon as I say a blank universal app, I'll get all three projects at the same time. I'll get a Windows project, I'll get a phone project, and I'll get the shared project in between. So the two heads in the shared. I'll go ahead and say go, and let it create that for me. I want to demonstrate a little bit around the syntax for async here, but I want to do it in the context of the .NET for WinRT is an abbreviated version of .NET, the full-blown .NET framework, right? There are things that are not in it that are in the full-fledged .NET framework. Some of the things that were taken out and put into the runtime because they were intended to be language-dependent so that if I was in C++, I was interacting with the file system identically to the way that somebody C# was interacting with the file system, to the way that somebody in JavaScript using WinJS was interacting with the file system. I wanted all those to be the same, and in order to make them the same, I can't leave it in .NET because .NET's only for .NET. So I had to bring it down into the framework. And so one of the changes is going to be around file I/O. So for example, if you were going to access a file in .NET, we all know it's system.io.file, right? It's easy enough. System.io.file does not exist, right? And so now if you're a regular .NET developer and you roll into the framework, you're ready to go to town, and the namespaces that you're familiar with are gone. Right? It can be jolting at first, but then you relax over time. All right, so let me. I'll open it up here. It doesn't matter if I do this, by the way, in Phone or if I do it in Windows. These are going to be exactly identical. So, for that's sake, I'll do it in Windows since this is a Windows presentation. And so here's the main page. I'm going to go down to Navigated to right here. And let's start by accessing all the different folders that I have. So this is isolated storage. We've had that all the way back to in .NET on the desktop, right? Isolated storage is a dedicated folder system only accessible to my application, right? It's stored under my profile up in app data. And I can do anything with it that I want to, right? So that's my local folder. But I also have a temporary folder. That would be where I would not worry if those files got deleted. They would get deleted while my application was not running. So it's a possibility they would be there when I ran again, but it's not a guarantee. I also have this idea of roaming folder, where I can put things in that folder. And if the user has my app installed on another device, it'll roam from that device to this device, so I'll have them both. That's very cool. I can do it both as files as well as a settings dictionary, which is pretty neat. Then there's a fourth one called local cache. And so local cache, I have local folder and local cache. And local folder is that folder where I put whatever I need, but it doesn't roam or anything like that. Local cache is identical to that, with the exception of it doesn't get backed up either. So if this device crashes, then local folder will have to be rebuilt, but that's probably okay with me because a crash is pretty unlikely, a total system crash. So that's local cache. And the thing you might put in there, let's say you're writing Audible or some sort of application that used massive files, right? And you don't want to have a negative impact on the user's backup strategy. That's where you would put them in the cache. So let's go ahead and get that first. It's under the application data namespace, window.storage.application. And I'll say it's a local, var local equals data.current.localdata. Local, not cache. Local folder. All right, so this goes and gets it for me. It figures out where my local folder is, pulls back, and now I have a reference to the folder that I want. Remember, this is not only do I not have system.io.file, I also don't have system.io.directory. This comes back not as a system.io directory, though. It comes back then as a storage folder, right? And that's the new API, windows.storage. And so from there, I may want a subfolder, right? So I could say var folder equals local dot, and then create async, not create file, create folder async. And I would, because it's async, I know that I need to await it right here. And that await will wire up for me, but I won't be able to await it until I decorate first the method that I'm in as asynchronous, right? So I'll just go up here and say async. Now it'll work just fine. And now inside here, I'm going to say I want to create a folder. We'll call this my folder, you could call yours whatever you want. And then it's going to have a conflict creation collision option. And I'll say if it's already there, go ahead and open it, otherwise create it. Right? So it's sort of like a create or get. All right, so now I've done two things. I've gone into my local folder root. I've gone to the subfolder. Now I want to create a file, so I can say var file equals await folder.create, and you saw create file just a second ago. It's going to ask for its name. It's going to be called myfile.txt, we'll say for now. It'll also have a collision, right? And it will be creation collision option, C-R-E-A-T, there it is. And I'll say the same thing as well. Oh, no, in this case, I'll say just replace the existing, right? So I don't have to worry about it. So now I've done it. I've gone into my local folder, gone into my subfolder, created my first file. Now I want to write things out. And I'll say var content equals hello TechEd. There we are. And I'll write this out. Now I can do this a couple different ways. I could convert this into a stream, write it out as a stream into the file, and then close it. That's a lot to do. There's a couple helper methods to help the obvious stuff that I'm doing. And so this is going to be file.io. I'll say await. System. It's is also going to be window.storage.file.io. And so here I could say write text async. What do you want me to write? First of all, write to this file. Second of all, write this content. Now all the content will be streamed in there. It'll be closed. I don't have to worry about it. This, by the way, isn't a normal stream. This is a random access stream that doesn't need to be disposed of, right? So you don't hit the same locks that you would if you're writing a desktop application. So now I could say var read equals fileio.read text async. Let me await it. File. So let's look what just happened. So now I just wrote it out. It took hello TechEd. I wrote it into the file. The next thing I do is I read it. Now, there are awaits all over this, right? Each of those represents another handler that if we were to try and do all this asynchronously and do it without the await keyword, we'd go crazy with the number of methods that you'd have to follow along. Not only that, now I can debug it. I can step right over it, whatever I need to. I can wrap it inside a try-catch if I need to, and it's all contained inside a single context, unlike if I had multiple methods. And so now I can read it. If I wanted to, I could say debug. You wouldn't have to do it this way, but you could say debug.assert that content equals whatever it read out, right? Now you could just test it to make sure that whatever you read out matches whatever you wrote in. Now here's something else that's cool, and if you're a Windows Phone developer, you already know that you can send an email. In fact, you can send a text message. You can do all kinds of things. Anything that the phone can do, you can basically do. There are tasks to allow you to do it. You can do the same thing here. There's a nice feature that's been included in this rev. If I say var email equals new email message, right, there we go. I can start by saying subject equals TechEd. But now I can do some cool things, like let me start with to.add new email recipient, dpeuswatlive.com, right? I'll just say. But I also want to send the file that I just created. I created the file. I'd like to send that as well. Attachments in Windows Phone by email just weren't possible before. Now you can do it, and it's pretty straightforward. You say email.attachments.add new attachment, just like that. Now it's going to ask for the file, and so it'll be file.name file. It'll ask what to call it in the email, and then it'll ask for the file itself, and it'll do all the work for me. It's pretty great. And then the final thing will just be it'll be the email manager. Here's the email manager.send And so what this actually does is doesn't send the email, no, not at all. It actually now prompts the user and says, all right, now the application here has just asked you to send an email. How would you like to send that email? Would you like to first pick which account you want to use? Then do you want to edit it first? Then you can send it. So I can't actually send the email on behalf of the user. I can only prompt the operation or the workflow to begin. So here I can go to, this obviously needs to be awaited because my UI is going to be behind the email UI now, right? And so if I were to show you what this looks like, I'll go ahead and start it up. A cool change to the, wait a minute, this is the Windows app. I got to change the startup project to be the Windows Phone project. A cool change to the emulator for Windows Phone. One of the changes is it used to not be possible for you to log in with your Microsoft account. Because you couldn't log in with your Microsoft account on the emulator, it also meant that there are things you couldn't test, including email, right? You just had to hope that it would work or deploy it out to your physical device and run it from there. So now I can go into the emulator. I can log in and make sure that it's set up for my email and ready to go so I can test the full use case. Let's try this again. Well, this is real sadness. What is the problem?
unable to debug what is store at.
Well, that's bad luck right there is what it is. We've got to get it to work. We've got all kinds of neat things to show you. I mean, all kinds of neat things to show you. Let's try it again. La-da-da-da-da. Come on. This is not the way it's supposed to happen. Let's try again. I'll clean it. This is a bad deal. Well, roll with the punches. You got to roll with the punches. Here's what would have happened. It would have popped up and asked me if I wanted to send it, and I would have said yes, and I guess that's really the only part you missed. But the syntax is right. The debugger just wouldn't attach. Am I doing something wrong? Does anybody see? Unable to activate Windows Store, blah, blah, blah. The activation request failed. This app does not support the contract specified. What contract would I have missed? I don't have a contract. Well, farfignugan, man, this is not the way it's supposed to go. This demo, I've only done this demo 100,000 times. Look at that. No, you have to do it 5 times instead of 4. All right, so this is what it actually looks like. That's kind of crazy. My application, you didn't even see load. That's because I did everything in the unnavigated to event, so it was really quick. It went ahead and launched that email UI. This is the email UI. It's a funny UI when I only have one choice to make. You know, you'd think you'd be able to guess what my choice is, but that's just me talking. So I would select, let's say, Outlook, and as soon as I say Outlook, that's just the name of the email account that I have currently set up. Here's a new email dialog. I can go in and change whatever it is that I want to change. You can see the attachment is sitting there as well. If I went ahead and sent it now, it goes up. You can see that I've got that little card-looking thing in the top left corner of the emulator. That's showing me that I have a new toast notification. So if I were to drag that down like so, it will show you all of the different it will show you all the different messages I got, including the message that I just sent myself, which now I'm wondering why. Not there. Open up Outlook. Well, there it is. It just hadn't shown up yet. Now it shows up. Mr. Microsoft showed it. So I open up that message. You can see I've got an attachment right there. If I tap on the attachment, it goes ahead and downloads it, prepares it for Microsoft Word to open it. If I were to open it up, it would say, "Hello, TechEd," and that's as easy as that, right? Pretty cool. It's really cool, actually. Hold your applause till the end, please. All right, so we talked about the different storage locations that you can use. I think we also, let's see, is there one other? The only other one that might even be worth considering is you also have a project location of your install folder. This is a read-only folder, just like it was in Windows Phone. That hasn't changed at all, but it's a great place to send initial data, right? You have lookup values or something like that. All right, let's look on past that. So you've chosen WinRT, you've chosen the Windows runtime. Now you're headed that way for your Windows and Windows Phone app. There's a few things that you really should know, right? Some gotchas that kind of hit you along the way. The first one is sort of just a kind of a funny thing, but it's real nonetheless, is the fact that there is no message box, right? Most developers are ready. That's how the message box is a key debugging tool for them. And so the first thing they notice is that there's no message box, and that's only because message box is a modal synchronous call, right? Dot show. And so instead we've created a UI that is system-wide, and it's not a control inside a specific framework or anything like that. And it's our ability to call out to a message dialog. So this is a message dialog that allows me to make a couple of changes. On Windows Phone, it's really nice because, you know, we had the message box before, and it would say things like, do you really like my app? And it would say, okay, cancel, right? So you would have to interpret what yes really meant. You couldn't change those buttons. The nice thing about the message dialog is I can add my own buttons, and I can add my own text, and then I can add my own handler to each of those buttons to do whatever they want to. So those are called UI commands. So in this case, I've created two UI commands, an okay and a cancel. The cancel does nothing. It doesn't actually need a handler. It just closes the dialog. But I might want to do something. I easily could. And if I did, I would follow the syntax above, where I say okay, and then I give it a delegate, right? In that case, I'm giving it a Lambda delegate, but I didn't have to do it that way. I could have just pointed to a method that has the right signature as well, right? So it says to do, and that's where you would actually do it. And so at the very bottom, you can see it's just a show async. That's because what you're showing is you're allowing your application to relax while the UI is there. Some of the more complicated tasks that you do inside Windows Phone are handled by Microsoft.phone.tasks, right? Things like I need to go to the marketplace and prompt the user so that they can rate my application. No problem. I need to open a web browser, let's say. I need to do all kinds of different things. All those are handled by tasks, and there is no Windows Microsoft.phone.tasks anymore. That's because a shared namespace wouldn't have phone in it, for one. So how do we do things like going to the marketplace? The way we do that now is to go to a specific URI. So we have a custom protocol. A protocol, for example, of HTTP colon is a code that says you need to launch a browser and pass this information to it. If I say mail to colon, that's code that says you need to launch your mail client and pass this string to it. No problem, right? That's the way things work. And so we can create custom protocols that do different things as well. The store inside phone is Zune, right? Talk about legacy. And so you say Zune colon. You can also say MS-Windows-Store:, as well. This is a nice short version of it. You can say Zune colon, and it'll open up the store for you, and it'll pass the string along. And so we put it in the shape of a query string, and you can do that as well. If you need to open that URI or URL, right, the way you do that is you're no longer using a web browser task because none of the tasks are there anymore. Now we use launchers. So Windows is loaded with lots of different launchers, and each of the launchers can do different things. One of them is the URI launcher. And when you launch a URI, it's not actually a web browser task, right? It's actually just a URI launcher, and it's whatever that protocol is, it will launch. So a URI launcher saying mail to colon, da-da-da, is going to launch your mail app, right? It's pretty nice. There are other things you might want to do, address chooser, make a phone call, compose an SMS message, and the list actually goes on. I mean, this is just an abbreviated list. Each of them has an equivalent, and here are the namespaces here. Most of them are handled either inside launchers or inside application model. Now, one of the cool things is because the user loves Windows Phone because apps that don't have a pixel currently visible are suspended. And suspended applications don't take up resources and don't kill my performance, like we talked about at the beginning. However, sometimes it's really important in different scenarios for code to still run even though your app isn't running. So we have background tasks that allow us to do that. And so we have background tasks in Windows Phone that do all kinds of different things. It can do background transfer, file transfer over the internet. You can do regular timed background tasks that are periodic. You can have background tasks that only work whenever it's on AC and Wi-Fi. You can have background tasks meant especially for just location, right? So all of those have equivalents, but not identical equivalents inside the new model. And so now we have background agents or background tasks, but the new WinRT tasks have a couple things that are different about them. The first thing is a task will only run if it has a trigger. So one of the triggers you might have is simply time. Another one you might have might be whether or not the user is there, maybe if the internet is present, maybe, and all these different things. So when these things occur, that's the trigger that causes your background task to run. And you would couple that with zero or more conditions. So you could say when this time occurs, but only if there's internet connectivity, and only if, and you just fill in the blank using as many conditions that you can. The reason you use as many conditions as you can, because you don't want to waste time inside your background task, because unlike Windows Phone, where everything was based on a wall clock, Windows runtime is all based on a CPU clock. So you don't have a certain number of seconds to complete like you did in Windows Phone. Now you have CPU seconds, and the reality is you only have 2 CPU seconds, and that goes very, very quickly. So you have to think really clearly and keep your mind clear while we're developing on exactly what you want to accomplish in a background task. You can still do a lot, right? You can still update your tile. You can still send a toast notification. You can still download a file. You can still trigger things to occur. All those things are there. You just have to be very judicious about the work that you're actually accomplishing, because now there are constraints and quotas around CPU, memory, bandwidth utilization, all kinds of things. And remember, this is all in the context of we're protecting the user so that they can trust more and more apps that they're downloading, right? That's the idea. And so you can see there the quotas about CPU time, network memory, and wall clock. There's no longer the concept of an intensive task that would just burden and just get your phone freaking hot, right? Those are gone. And there are a couple other ones that are not gone. They just aren't here yet. And an example would be background audio. Obviously, background audio is an important background task, right? And it just didn't make the cut yet, right? In this version of phone, you don't see the background audio task. You also do not see the real-time location task. This is that background task that will allow an app to give turn-by-turn navigation, or maybe it's tracking me as I'm running, so it knows exactly where I am. And again, this is just one of those scenarios that hasn't made it yet. And so this is a scenario where your app really fits and you're like, holy Moses, I really need to be able to do real-time location, no problem. That's still fully supported in the Silverlight scenario, right? Absolutely. All right. So that's background tasks. Yes, sir. Okay, so the question was whether or not there's a way to call back between Silverlight and WinRT. And I assume what you mean is you can call back between a UI built in Silverlight and a background task built in WinRT. Ah, mix and match APIs, yeah. Yeah, you make your choice, you have to stick with it. What you'll find is that Silverlight 8.1 has been revved up to do a good job of matching all the available APIs, not one-to-one, but really close. So if you're like, look, I have to go the Silverlight route, you're going to be pretty happy with the scenario that you have. I mean, eventually things are going to diverge, right? But right now it's actually a really good story. And right now, Silverlight 8.1 on the phone is a slight superset over WinRT, only because WinRT is just like catching up, right? That's just a matter of time. That'll overtake by a lot. Okay, so now, what if you use live tiles? Every app has a tile, not every app has a live tile. Live tile would be the notifications that you send to it so it flips over or slides up or does whatever it is that you want as far as animation. That's pretty cool. So if you have a live tile, how do you do that inside Windows Phone? WinRT, you do that with the Tile Update Manager. And so the Tile Update Manager is going to be different. This is the way that you do it, and if you've built it out and you already know that it's a series of XML files that you're really updating and passing those XML files to the updater, those XML templates have changed as well. They match now the templates that are in Windows, right? And so that's a big deal. At the same time, it's worth pointing out that if you don't like those templates, right, they just don't satisfy you, there's a XAML rendering background task now that you can use on the phone that'll allow you to create your own tile as an image. So you can put the text wherever you want. You can lay it out however is beautiful to you using XAML. Then you just render that as an image and show that as your tile. So it's really up to you how you end up doing it. Tiles now can be done four different ways, right? We can update them locally. That's when your app updates them, or maybe your background task just simply updates a number or something like that. You can schedule it and then push that off into the future, saying, okay, with this time and date, I want you to update using this information, which is great. Or you can say periodic, so that's every certain period. I want you to go to a URL that's out on the internet, and it's going to have updated XML. I want you to use that instead. It's another way to update your tile. And then push notifications are another way where I can say, I want to, from a server point of view, I know that there's a tornado coming. I'm going to send them up to the notification server. It's going to send it out to the devices, and that's going to update the tile or produce a toast or whatever it is that I want it to do. Now, inside Windows Phone, one of the coolest things about Windows Phone is that it has a back button. And that seems trivial, but it's actually quite awesome, right? I wish Windows had a back button, to be honest, now that I love it so much. And the back button allows me to navigate through. We use the Silverlight navigation framework, and so now it's just the WinRT navigation framework. But basically, it's a frame with pages in it. We go from one page to another. And when we click the back button, we expect, just like when we're in a browser, for it to navigate for us back to the previous page. However, what actually happens is we click the back button, and it terminates our application, because that's the behavior in Windows. Because Windows doesn't have a back button, and now that we're creating a universal application, we have to have a consistent kind of operation between them. So what do? Well, it's easy enough. Fortunately, we have the hardware buttons backpressed event that we simply have to be able to handle. If we don't handle it, then the back button simply means terminate my application. Okay, we don't want that to happen. So we put this either globally, we could put this in our app XAML, or individually in the code behind of every page that you have. Right? And it's up to you to handle it in different ways. You might go back under certain conditions and not under others, but the reality is simply this. When you were writing a Silverlight app in Windows Phone, the back button was handled out of the box. Now it is not. Every time you hit the back button, it's going to try and terminate your app unless you put these three lines here, right, to make sure that you navigate back in the frame. Why those don't default into the phone template? I would not be the right guy to ask. I would have done it. Although, you know what, I often say that sort of thing only to find there's some logical reason that I just didn't know at the time. All right. If you use the networking API, that is to say, if you use system.net.http client, that there is no longer a need to do that. Now you can use windows.web.http client, and there's a lot of good reasons to do it. One, that has now become the standard way across all languages to interact with HTTP calls. You can add all the headers. It has advanced security that other just don't have, including it has all the investment in it that's coming, right? This is the way to interact with the network directly over HTTP. It's hopefully this makes sense, but it's also fully asynchronous. It's ready to go. And so you'll see the same implementation in every language, even over in JavaScript. If you use localization, well, there's no getting around it. There's a lot of phones, not only in the United States, but also in other countries as well. So if you were using localization before in Windows Phone, the way that you did it was you had a ResX file, right? This is a resource file that you would have all your different strings in there, and you would have different files for different languages, and they would have a little name inside. The culture would have a string inside the name of the file, and you'd go from there. We no longer do it that way. Honestly, I'm really glad we don't. It's a lot easier now. We use a ResW file. Both of them were just XML files, just a slight different specification. And so down here in the text block, you can see the only thing that's really interesting here is this XUID on the third line. So the second line is your X name, right? That's just a name of your control that you might interact from code behind. The reality is, as a rule of thumb, if you have X name, you're probably not doing MVVM right in the first place, but that's up to you. XUID, on the other hand, really doesn't refer to the name. It's really trying to correlate it into the resource file so you can find the data that it wants. So I might have two controls on the same page, and they both have the same XUID, right? Because the XUID really has more to do with localization inside that resource file. And so maybe to make it more clear, I'll demo it here in just a second. But we'll start by just some realizations that, let's call it 90% of Windows phones are not in the United States. And so if you are making an application and you're like, you know, this is an interesting topic about localization, I'm not interested though, right? I just want to bring it to your attention that if you're going to take the time to write an application, there are other people that don't speak English and that could potentially buy your application, buy whatever it is that you sell on the inside your app and monetize it for you, right? You're really giving up a lot of opportunity if you don't consider the internationalization of your application. In fact, here are the 9 markets where Windows Phone is currently number 2. Of them, 1 speaks English, and the rest all speak English, but certainly not as their primary language, right? I think that's worth at least just noticing, right? This list of different countries changes depending on month to month and all the different metrics, but still, there's no United States in there, right? And so as you write it, there is a value to localization. There's just no getting around it. There's a tremendous value to localization. I think it's worth saying there's a difference between globalization and localization as well. Localization is translating your strings into another language, where localization is making sure that your application fits other cultures. Things like currency, the way that you display dates, and on like that, right? There's a lot of different things that you might do. So if you want to do both localization, that's the translation of your strings, and globalization to prep for other cultures as well. So we talked about XUID and its ability to pull from this resource that's ResW. So here's ResW down here with its name value pair of string 1. And I can then call string 1, or I can call, in this case, I'm calling title.txt, and I'll show you exactly what I mean because sometimes you don't want to use XUID. Sometimes you don't want it to automatically try and map for you. Sometimes you want to pull that out because you're going to show it in a message dialog or something like that, and it can't always be bound for you kind of automagically. So let me pull up back up to our project here. So here's our project. All right, just like this. I'll stop debugger. Woo. Stop the debugger. So if you were going to localize your app, you start by moving everything into strings. And so I'll begin. This is my phone app right here. I'm going to right click and I'm going to create a new folder. And this is, for the sake of convention, I will call it strings. It can actually be called just about anything. It's the next folder that really matters. So the next folder, I'm going to name a culture. So we're currently English United States. So that's EN-US. That's what I will name this, EN-US. And inside this folder, I'll add a new resource file. So we'll go just like this. New item. And it is a resource, not a resource dictionary. It is a resource file, an RESW. So I won't change the name of it. I'll just add it directly. You can see it's just the name value pair with your ability to make a comment on each line. I'll leave it like this just for a second, and I'll go into the main page. So here's main page. I'm going to add a text block, and I'll make it a style, static head, let's see, and then I'll give it a text value of hello. There we are. Great. All right, so let's just pretend this is the app that we're going to make. Let's pretend that it is a video player, and the video player needs a title. And I'm going to make that title in English. And so we'll start by this XUID. I don't need an X name or anything like that. I'll say XUID, and this is going to be called the main page title, T-I-T-L-E. So this is not something I can use in code behind to call it. This is really meant for correlation back to the resource file only. So now I'll open up that resource file, and I'll go here. And this is what you might think. The player, right? And so now, main page title equals the player, but that's not right. I need to make a second connection. And it goes like this. This is main page title dot text. The reason I do main page title dot text is because depending on what the different culture that I'm going into is, I may actually want to change something else. I may need to change left to right to left. I may need to change the font size to be slightly smaller, because if I don't make it smaller, it's not going to fit that giant name that they need. Right? So I can go down here, I can do another one, and I'll say foreground, and we'll make it blue. So whenever it's in English, the text will read the player, and then the color will turn to blue. Now, I could go right here, and I could say, let's create another one. So I'll create a new folder, fr.fr, right? This is French. I'll say new item again. I won't change the name of the resource file. And in fact, to make it easier so I don't have to do so much typing, I'll just copy the English resource file and move it into the French one for us. Well, that didn't do what I thought it would. I got to build first is the reason. All right. Now I'll copy it, put it into French. When I open it up, I can say, all right, first of all, when it's in France, it's going to be red. And it's going to be in French that you're going to translate the player to le player. So now, it's probably not right, but I don't know French. So now when I change the culture, not of Windows, but of Windows Phone, it's going to translate it over to le player, and it's going to make it so that it's red. So let me go ahead and run it. And so when I debug here, it'll run in what the language Windows Phone is already set up for me. So the emulator is already running in English, and I need to drop that one piece out of main page so it stops trying to send an email. Sorry about that. So now it'll come up, and it should be blue and the player, even though in the designer, don't forget, it was white and it was a little tilde hello or tilde title. Well, I do that tilde, by the way, as just a just a little reminder that this is going to be pulled from a resource file. I don't mistakenly overlook it that way. All right, so now I'm going to go to the phone. I'm going to go in, and I'm going to change my settings. I'm going to go down to language. Right? Location, keyboard, language. Got it. Now I'm going to add French, French. FR, oh boy. F. Right there. French, French. And as soon as I do, wait a minute. French, France. Francais, yes. Francais, France. Great. Let's hope that nobody is French in here, I hope. God, I just tear it up. All right. I'll say go. And so here it is. I will move this up. It's the second button from the top. I'll say for it to restart the phone. It says au revoir. That means please wait. And a second later, the Windows phone will start up. I'll restart my debugging session as soon as it's back. And I'll wait for it. Wait for it. Not for resale. If you want to buy this emulator, you can't. It's pretty funny. And so now it'll go ahead and deploy and run it. And this time it'll listen to whatever the culture is. You can see it switches over to French and also changes the color. So it's no longer blue, right? So now I have all the localization strings. But let's pretend that what you really want to do is you want to do it also in German. Now, this time I'm not going to go through the process of doing it again. In fact, if I were to do all this again, I would do it all in English and I would leave it alone. And the reason I would is because I want to use the multilingual toolkit to do the work for me from here forward. And so, for example, if I go, once I have the toolkit installed, by the way, which is part of the, it's just an extension, you can search for it, it's really easy to get. I can go up to Tools, and one of the options, the first one in the menu option says Enable the Multilingual App Toolkit, right? So I'll say Go, right? And now it's enabled. But I'm not quite sure what that actually does. And now I'll right-click the project, and I have a new option now. You can see right about the middle, it says Add a New Translation Language. It'll say, which one do you want to add? I'll say, well, what I really want to add is German. Here we are. Right? Here we are. And now, so I have a multilingual resource folder added for me, and it has the two new languages in it. I don't have a new resource W file that I need to mess with. Instead, I double-click this file, which is of type XLIF, which is an XLF, not XLIF. An XLIF file is a standard file you would use in any translation service. If there was a professional translation service you were working with, they would understand it, XLIF file, they would accept and give it back to you in this format. So that's one of the benefits starting right here, right? You can interact with a professional translator, which I think is worth at least commenting on, that le player might be offensive to the French, right? You would actually want to try and get something that was that meant something to them. So I'm going to go ahead and open up German because I want to show you something. Actually, I'm going to allow that to open, close it, then I'm going to build. Build is important because it doesn't actually get populated until we build. Then I'll double-click it. So this is our XLIF editor. You see at the bottom there's a little grid with two things in it. One is the player and the other one is blue. And now this is pretty cool. So I'll go down to blue, let's say, and there's a drop down here that says, is this translatable in the first place? It is absolutely not translatable. If I get back the German word for blue, XAML will simply just not show it, right? And I don't want that to happen. So I'll say, no, this is not translatable, but I will manually make a change and say, instead of blue, I want it to be green. Now, I want it to be green after I say that. Now I want it to be green. And now it's not translatable. So I don't have to worry about it doing it. It's locked, basically. So here's what's cool. The first thing is I could take this FLIF file, XLIF file, send it off to a professional and have them translate it. The other thing I could do is I could go up to the Bing Translate button at the top, and I could let Bing's language engine look at the word that I have and attempt to translate it. Now, there's a couple things you should know. First, if you're an MSDN subscriber, you can go into MSDN Downloads today, and you can download a gigantic spreadsheet of common buttons that are in UI, right? It's a gigantic spreadsheet of common UI button terms. Go, save, open, file, I mean, everything you can imagine. And then lots and lots and lots of language options right after it. So if you're like, man, I wonder how you say save in Polish, right? Well, that's where you can start, right? If you don't have a professional Polish friend who wants to do it for you. Or, a non-professional Polish friend that wants to do it for you. All right, so I can go up here and I can say, all right, I want to translate all. It goes and it talks to the server for me, and it tries to translate the player to der player, which sounds like I'm making that up, but I'm totally not. I didn't even know there's gonna. I didn't choose German until just now. That's hilarious. So I'll go ahead and accept it, but I have to say, you really should go back and validate what Bing gives you back, because you never know. It could accidentally mean like something like, I don't know what, but it. I don't know. Anybody speak German? I guess that's probably right on. We'll just leave it at that. All right, now I will say, if I were to right-click my project again, and I would say add another translation language, I could just go to town here, and I could start adding and adding and adding, and I could tell the Bing service to just quickly give me all the ones that you have for all of them. And then I have 1, 2, 3, 10, 20 things to check before I'm done, but I am way down the road, right? I'm way down the road and quickly done it, so I don't have to recreate all these resource files, make sure that the folder's named correctly. The multilingual toolkit handles all of that for me. It's pretty cool all the way around, don't you think? Another piece, in fact, let me jump back here. There's the multilingual toolkit, which, by the way, if you don't know how to search any other way and you haven't found Bing yet, you can use aka.ms/multilingual. It'll take you directly to the download page for it. All right. Say it again. Bing does have a translate service. Absolutely, it does. That's right. It's pretty great too. And in fact, it has a service you can call as a REST service that you can use in other ways too. It does, doesn't it? I know. You know what? All kinds of things like that went through my mind. I tried to not say anything. Yeah. but yes, player. For those that are just listening to the recording, the point was made that player means different things in English. All right, if you use orientation and you go from portrait to landscape, then that's slightly changed. Now we do against the window.current and we wait for the size changed event. Hopefully you're using Hopefully you're using visual states to handle that. Here's an example of how you might do it. So you switch between two different visual states that you have. I want to point you back to jerrynixon.com, my blog, where I also have an orientation behavior that you can drag on, and it'll pick all your different visual states for you and swap them without you even having to look at the code. But nonetheless, if you wanted to do it, this is the way you do it. You basically just attach to window.current.sizeChanged. So there's a big change around file pickers. And boy, this is a big old deal. This is a big, big deal. The way file pickers used to work and the way that they work in Windows for now is the way is your app is running, and then you say to the user, go get a file. And so as soon as you say go get a file, you open up the file picker. File picker is on top of your application. The user then goes and picks whatever file they want, comes back and hands it off to your application. Seems straightforward, but there's a problem. Not all Windows phones, not all devices are made equally. Some of them are very low memory devices. And so now there's a problem. You have your application, and you have your 3D animation, and it's beautiful, and your app is cool, and it's great, and we say, all right, now we need to go pick a file. So now, on top of your 3D animation, we have a file picker running, and this is not an ordinary file picker. This is a file extension that they have installed so they can go out to like box.com and go get a file from there as well. So now, the memory and resource constraint usage of your application compounded with the memory resource usage of the special extended file picker that they're using as well is overwhelms the application, right? Overwhelms the device, and nothing works properly, and they hate everything about it, right? They throw the phone down, right? That's what we don't want to happen. So now we have, instead of just an ordinary file picker, we have continuation. And so this is what happens. Your application is running, and you say, hey, go get a file for me. No problem. The window comes up, and at the exact same time, actually 5 seconds later, your application is suspended. And so it's suspended on purpose because we've only got so much memory to play with, right? And so now your application is suspended. They're going and they're going wherever it is they go to get their file. They're going to Sky OneDrive, or they're going to Box, or they're going somewhere, and they're playing along, and they still run out of memory. Now what happens now, as soon as they run out of memory, all suspended apps start getting terminated immediately. The reason they get terminated immediately is because they're like, we got to make up all this stuff. Background tasks get canceled. Everything that we can do starts happening. So now the user's experience is still protected. They still have a nice experience. They pick whatever file they want from whatever system they want and go. And then the file picker closes, and what happens next? Your application is resumed as if it never quit, except for it was actually terminated, which means everything you have in state, everything you have as a static variable, everything you have that's loaded is now gone. You're terminated. So instead, you're resumed and activated, which is brutal if you think about it. And inside that activation context that you have a series of arguments sent to you that include the file that was picked, a handler to that file to give you permission to use it, as well as other information you may have passed along the way. So right when you made the call, you could say, hey, and don't forget the letter A. Because now that I'm resuming, I have the letter A. Well, the letter A means, and then maybe that means something to you, so that it goes to this file and it opens up this piece, and now you know we're back where you were before. Which means, right before I tell the user to go pick a file, I have to save a whole bunch of state information first, because I want to make sure that the user comes back to where they were to start with. Well, this is a lot of thinking. And there's no, I don't. By the way, that was not a quippy thing to say, and this is why you can, this is the easy way out. There is no easy way out, because in order to handle devices that have low memory, this is the way that it works. So we call this file picker continuation, file open continuation, file save continuation, both of those. And the idea is, as soon as a file picker comes up, you're suspended. You may not be terminated. It may be a fast resume, right? I have a 920. That's my phone. I'll never be terminated. I have plenty of RAM. No problem. But on a low device, it might be. So now it's just a fast resume up right to where I was before. Activated occurs. Now I just pass the file that the user picked, right? It can be really easy, but I have to be able to account for the situations where it may not be as easy, right? So here we are. This is file click. You can see that I picked the picket. And the third line there says picker.singlefile, pick single file and continue. Right? It used to just say pick single file async. So there's no point in awaiting it, right? I'm about to be suspended. And so this is what the continuation looks like. The continuation is the unactivated event inside XAML, inside XAML CS, and or app XAML CS, sorry. And there may be lots of kinds that you already support. Right? You have activation for all kinds of reasons. Somebody tapped the secondary tile. Somebody tapped the first tile, the primary tile. Maybe somebody is using your app as a picture provider, all kinds of different ways it's activated. In this case, it's the pick file continuation. Right? And so as soon as that happens, I know that I can take the arguments passed to me, and I can convert those into the file open picker continuation of inargs, which is where I could get all the file information. From there, I hand that off to this.onContinue file, one file open picker, whatever that is, right? That's the magic. That's the method that you get to write as an app developer, figuring out how you're going to solve this inside your app. The way I do it is I navigate to the page, I pass the page type, and as soon as I know the page type, I just navigate to that page, passing the event args, and handle it on the page side. It's going to be up to you how you do that. Maybe you have all singleton view models, and you want those view models to handle it instead. Maybe use messaging inside yours. Fine. You can use messaging, and you're going to do it that way as well. There's a lot of different ways to do it. And so anyway, this is a kind of a catch. The reason we have continuation is because devices can be low in memory. The reason we have continuation is if they run out of memory, your app's going to be terminated anyway, right? And so now we can do things gracefully and with a plan. And Windows is being tuned, not Windows Phone now. Windows is being tuned to run on different devices as well. It wouldn't surprise me if you would see this on other devices as well, on what we sometimes call big Windows, right? Yeah. All right. There's continuation. There's also the share contract. Applications are inside they have a boundary around them, so they can't touch other applications. That's really important to keep them all safe. But sometimes it's just the right thing to be able to send some sort of information to another application you have installed. For example, you may be looking at an app and you're showing a map, and you're showing, let's say it's a geocaching app, you're showing the map, the location, and the information about that geocache, and you'd really like to put this on Facebook. I mean, you'd really like to. But you don't want to write the whole Facebook API. That is exhausting, especially when you figure 99% of all the users out there already have the Facebook app installed. So now I can use the share contract to send out information, and they can send it, it'll come from my application, and then the user can choose where it goes to. You think they're going to send it to Facebook, but the reality is these people live in a country where Facebook's not that big of a deal. Instead, it's their local Facebook, and they have that installed as well. And so now, not only did you not have to write the Facebook API to be able to support Facebook, but you've written it in such a way that you can support other APIs, because now it's now tied to the different apps that the user has installed. You thought it was going to be Facebook, but it's Twitter. You thought it was going to be Twitter, but it's something local, something personal, something else, right? It's really neat. And so this is what the share contract's all about. It's about a way of communicating in a lightweight way between two different applications, right? It's really nice. All right, so this is the way that it works. As soon as the data requested is raised, you set the different properties. Here you can see it's set text, but you can set binary, you can set images, you can set all kinds of different things like that. It's really nice. All right, so this is what we talked about today. We talked kind of where Windows Phone kind of came from and where it's headed. The reason that it's split between Silverlight and WinRT and kind of why you would choose between the two, we ran with the idea that this is WinRT that we're going to go with, and the reason is these are converged universal apps that run on Windows and Windows 8, and we can reuse the most code as we can, and we kind of see where the writing is on the wall. There's a future to it all as well. There's a lot of different pieces inside the runtime that we talked about, and I'll also be taking the code from this. That's akms/wpwinrt. I'll take this code, and we'll also have some other information available as well. And so if you're looking for the slides or the code, I'll put that up there in the next handful of days. And thanks for attending.